Next on Juno Afternoon, we'll talk with Angela Chapin about the Alaska Military Youth Academy. Dave Crabtree will fill us in on the latest CBJ water quality report. Phoebe Rohrbacher will be here to highlight Thursday's National HIV Testing Day. And we'll dig into local history as we talk with Renee Hughes about the Last Chance Mining Museum. That, Writer's Almanac, music and more, next on KTOO. Weather tonight, showers, highs around 53. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today, tribes, Native organizations, and communities across the country are participating in a National Day of Prayer for Native children. The National Indian Child Welfare Association says the events are sending a message of support to the family involved in an adoption case. As Toby Scott reports, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision in the case Monday.
The case, Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl, involved a Cherokee father and the estranged mother's planned adoption of their daughter to a South Carolina couple. The father had contested the adoption on the grounds that he was not first notified as required by the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. Writing for the majority in yesterday's 5-4 decision, Justice Alito said ICWA does not apply when a Native parent never had custody of the child in the first place. Terry Cross is director of the Portland-based National Indian Child Welfare Association, which filed an amicus brief in the case.
We're really disappointed in the ruling, but it is a very narrow ruling concerning the circumstances of this father in this particular situation. So while the case has been sent back to the South Carolina court for further consideration, we believe that the decision itself will affect a very narrow range of individuals, namely unwed fathers who don't step up to claim paternity before a child's born.
For National Native News, I'm Toby Scott.
The leader of Oklahoma's largest tribe is expressing his disappointment with Monday's ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court involving the Indian Child Welfare Act. KGOU's Kirk Courtney reports.
Speaking at a news conference after the High Court's decision yesterday, Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Bill John Baker said the ruling does not settle the issue of adoption of Native American children like Veronica Brown.
We are deeply, deeply disappointed that this case was not fully resolved. We believe Veronica Brown's best interests are served by continuing to live in a loving home with her biological father, Dustin Brown.
Baker says his tribe is concerned about protecting and strengthening the Cherokee Nation and will be with the Brown family every step of the way. A spokeswoman for the tribe says its attorneys continue to examine the Supreme Court decision. Other tribes across the country are also speaking out about the case. The Navajo Nation says it continues to support the father and the Cherokee Nation. The tribe was among those that filed amicus briefs about the importance of the ICWA. Tribes, advocates, and Native organizations are concerned about possible effects the ruling may have in Indian country. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Courtney.
At least one Northern Plains reservation will receive disaster aid to recover from late spring storms. Another is waiting for its own relief request. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
South and North Dakota were hit with severe storms in late May and early June. No one was killed, but there were millions of dollars in property and infrastructure damage. Tuesday, President Obama approved a disaster declaration for the Standing Rock Reservation, situated between South and North Dakota. Government funds will go to the region to cover repair or replacement costs for facilities damaged by the storm. The president has also received a request for assistance from the Pine Ridge Reservation in southern South Dakota for the same storm system. A tornado destroyed several buildings in the small reservation community of Allen, South Dakota. A few other counties in the region are hoping for federal disaster help as well. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
On June 25th and 26th, 1876, the Battle of the Little Bighorn took place in Montana. Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer and his men died fighting Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho warriors. The area today includes an Indian memorial honoring tribes that defended their way of life during the battle. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, 3.5-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2014, with applications accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Good afternoon and welcome to Juneau Afternoon. This is KTOO in Juneau. I'm Lori Scandling. Our guests this afternoon include Angela Chapin and Jeremy Heggie of the Alaska Military Youth Academy. Also this afternoon with us, Jeff Brown is on the board, and my co-host, Lisa Kunau, is joining us in the studio. Welcome, Angela and Jeremy. We briefly talked last week about an event that is this evening related to the Military Youth Academy. Can you give us the particulars about tonight's event?
Certainly. We're doing an orientation, which is just some basic information about our program and mentor program, at the downtown library tonight from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Any youth that are interested, parents, guardians, mentors, or just community members that are interested in learning about our program are welcome to attend.
Thanks, Angela. Can you explain a little bit more about how the mentorship program works?
Well, I'm actually going to pass that over to Jeremy Heggie because that is his position.
Sure. I'm actually the mentoring coordinator up in Anchorage. I am on Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, which is where the residential phase of the program of AMYA is. So the 22 weeks that the young folks check into our program and are on the ground and become cadets in the Alaska Military Youth Academy, that's where they're housed. In terms of the mentoring program, we're a little bit unique because what we like to do with our program is provide an additional positive, dedicated method of support to a young person through matching them with a mentor. And in order to be a mentor in our program, first of all, you do have to be 21 years of age. You have to fill out an application, of course, be willing to submit to a background check, and actually go through a training with us. And we do the trainings primarily through Anchorage, but we also have distance training available as well. And once we match them with a trained mentor, it provides that cadet another form of support in their life. They also work on specific plans that they build while they're at the academy to be successful there at the academy, but also to be successful in their life once they leave the academy. One thing that is very unique about our program is once they graduate the 22-week residential phase, they go into a year of post-residential follow-up. And during that year of post-residential follow-up, essentially they have to have 30 hours of productive work wherever they are. It could be going back to high school, could be going and starting in a job in the workforce, going into the military, a number of different avenues. And the mentor is sort of a key role during that time because they're that other point of contact for that person to help them through life's ups and downs.
What would you describe as the profile of the person who might most benefit from the Military Youth Academy? And I assume it's for males and females.
Yes, so we take both genders, and we're targeting youth that are 16 to 18 years of age who are in danger of not getting their high school education. So they've either withdrawn from high school or a GED program, or they're enrolled in school, but they're behind in credits and not in line to graduate with their peers. And those are the youth that we're looking for because we're just a one-time deal. It's 22 weeks that they live on our campus that they can earn the 7 high school credits. They can also take the GED exams and earn their GED. So for a lot of youth that are behind in credits, that gives them the opportunity to catch up. And so if they want to go back into high school, they would be in line to graduate with their peers. But if they're so far behind, they can get the GED. In the state of Alaska, you can actually get both. So youth who get their GED can actually go back into high school and still finish up and get their diploma. The other thing, we do offer diplomas at our program as well. If youth come in with enough credits and the right kind of credits combined with ours and have already passed their high school qualifying exams, we can actually issue a diploma. And that does happen every cycle, that we have a few that have enough credits to do that.
And so what is the cost of the program?
We are a tuition-free program, and youth that are accepted that are outside the road system, we actually pay for their flight into Anchorage. So the only cost to families would be our packing list if they're accepted, which is basic clothes and necessities. But even with that, if they can't find or afford the items, our program will take care of that for them.
Where could a potential applicant find out about the application process and the particulars of the application? Can they do that online, for example?
All the information is available online at akmya.org. There's a how to apply button. They can click that. And what they do is they enter their basic information, and the person for their area would get that and provide them with the application or the application process, because it's slightly different for those in Anchorage and those outside of Anchorage. But I am the contact person for Juno. My name's Angela Chapin, and you can always call me as well, 374-7960.
Do you have a limit as to the number of youth you can accept? It sounds like there are two cycles each year, each of about 5.5 months. What's the maximum number of youth you can take, meaning would somebody have to be placed on a wait list?
And we have been fortunate and have not had a wait list. So we can take up to 250 applicants each cycle. And we actually haven't always got that high. It always kind of depends on staffing and other issues. I think this cycle, our target is to take in 230 youth. And our next cycle does begin October 1st. Our cycles always run about October 1st and April 1st, just around those dates.
And so what is the success rate of participants in the program?
How we measure success is whether they are productive 30 hours a week through working, volunteering, or going back to school. And on average, 75% of our youth are being productive at the 12 months following our program.
Is that the percentage that finishes the program in 5.5 months, or that after they have graduated are successful 12 months later?
That's after they graduated. So of all the youth coming in, about 70% will graduate from our program, and of that, about 75% will continue to go on and be successful.
You know, I've heard of this program for many years. About how old is the Alaska Military Youth Academy, and how many graduates do you think you've had over that period?
We opened our doors in 1994, and I believe we are sitting about 3,500 graduates.
Fantastic. That's good news for youth who are looking for an alternative, it sounds like. Why don't you repeat the details of tonight's meeting and who ought to be interested in coming out? In other words, who your target audience is. So folks who are listening, they might know somebody they can give a call to and invite them.
Absolutely. Of course, youth that are struggling, their parents, guardians, anyone interested in mentoring or being a mentor wants to know more about that. Anybody in contact with youth that are struggling with school would be a good person to attend. And it is 5:30 to 7:30, the Juno Public Library, downtown, the large meeting room.
One last kind of detail question. In Alaska, you can drop out of high school without parental permission when you're 16. Do you need parental permission to join this program if you're already 16?
You do need parental permission. Because we take 16 to 18, obviously our 18-year-olds can sign all their own admission paperwork, but if they're under 18, they still need their parent or guardian to sign and give them permission to attend.
And one more time, the website?
akmya.org.
Thank you, Jeremy and Angela, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They give us a room with a view of the beautiful Rhine. They give us a room with a view of the beautiful Rhine. Give me a muddy old creek in Texas at any old time. I got those 1, 2, 3, 4 occupation GI blues. From my GI hat to the heels of my GI shoes. And if I don't go stateside soon, I'm gonna blow my fuse.
get hoss and pepper and black pumpernickel for chow. We get hoss and pepper and black pumpernickel for chow. I blow my next month pay for a slice of Texas cow. We like to be heroes, but all that we do here is march. We like to be heroes, but all that we do here is march. And they don't give the purple heart for a falling arch. I got those up, two, three, four, occupation G.I. blues. From my G.I. head to the heels of my G.I. shoes. And if I don't go stateside soon, I'm gonna blow my fuse. The Fraulein's are pretty as flowers, but we can't make a pass. The Fraulein's are pretty as flowers, but we can't make a pass. No, no. Cause they're always signs saying keep a G.I. off the grass. I got those hot poop, three, four, occupation G.I. blues. From my G.I. head to the heels of my G.I. shoes. And if I don't go stateside soon, I'm gonna blow my fuse.
Occupation G.I. blues.
Occupation G.I. blues.
Occupation G.I. blues.
Howdy.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling with co-host Lisa Kunow. Our next guest is Dave Crabtree. He is the superintendent of water for the municipality of Juno.
Hi, Dave. So can you explain to us a little bit more why we have a water quality report?
Sure. The purpose for our water quality report is to basically instill confidence in our treating methods, our regulatory requirements on the utilities, on a municipal utility, with how we go about treating and delivering water in a municipal water system.
And so why is this important to Junoites?
Well, number one, we are a capital city. Every citizen owns a piece of this water system. It's a municipal water system, therefore they own a part of this system. And they want to know that what they're drinking, what they're utilizing every day, whether they're showering or cooking, that they have good quality water service and at the best affordable price.
So how does Juno treat its water?
We have two water sources. One is the Last Chance Basin. That's a well system. And that system utilizes chlorine for its treatment system, primary disinfection. And the second source is the Salmon Creek water source, which is an interruptible source because it's a service water. And we treat that with chlorine and soda ash.
Mm-hmm. What do those two chemicals do to water that need to be done? I always think of the water in Juno as absolutely the freshest in the world. So why does water even need to be treated?
It's basically a regulatory requirement. We have to chlorinate our water. There's no getting around disinfecting your water with chlorination. As far as the soda ash requirement, we took some tests back in the early 80s, and we found that there were some spikes in the amount of what we thought was minerals leaching into people's home pipes. So what they did is they came up with a system as utilizing soda ash to help neutralize the water and help coat the pipes and prevent any potential minerals that could be getting in from your piping and your interior piping into your water.
Dave, have you worked in other communities as a water supervisor? Tell us a little bit about your background. This is a very specialized area, it seems.
Yeah, I've been with the city of Juno for August. It'll be 20 years. So I've been here for quite a while, started from the bottom and worked my way up. It's a beautiful town, great system to work in. I started my career working for the city of Cordova, water and wastewater utilities both. And the towns are very similar and very different. Juno being landlocked, as is Cordova. Juno system, well system, while Cordova system was a surface water system. What can I say about Juneau is that I love the town. I love the system I work for. I love the people. It's a great community. I couldn't have asked for a better career.
So the reason I asked about your background is, how does Juneau's water sources and system compare to other communities with which you might be familiar? In terms of, do we have a wonderfully pure water system, or are there other systems that, comparatively, maybe Juneau isn't as pristine and fresh as I envision it?
Great question. Juneau has a unique water system. Last Chance Basin is the purest of water. It's best high-quality water. Shallow wells, 90 feet deep. When you find other systems that have well systems, primarily in the lower 48, they can be anywhere between 900, 1,000, 1,500 feet deep for these wells. And the challenges of drilling such wells and maintaining good quality water that doesn't require as much treatment is really hard to come by. So we are definitely blessed with the sources that we have for water here.
We're lucky.
And so are there any particular concerns or issues that came up with the annual water quality report this year?
No concerns with the report. Like you can read it. It says that we've met all the requirements that we're required to meet in our quality report. You know, there's other items that we intend to put in there eventually to just help, you know, explain to the public our challenges with CIPs and engineering and dealing with rate studies and cost of service in Juneau. I know it rains a lot, but it is expensive to get water in a very linear community out to the masses.
Explain that last part of the sentence again. It's very hard to get water in a linear community out to the masses. So you must mean our geographical layout.
That's correct.
Talk about those challenges a little bit.
So in Juneau, we have nine reservoirs, storage reservoirs, and we have a multitude of pump stations and PRVs, pressure reducing stations. It's because our system, there's very short amount of flat land to develop in Juneau. Therefore, people have to build up on the sides of the mountains and the hills. We're required to put in more pump stations that you traditionally see in other utilities, municipalities. And our transmission lines have very few services on them per mile. When most traditional systems are a grid system, you have branches and lines running all directions, north, south, east, and west. Well, Juneau system isn't like that. We don't have the community to spread out like, say, Anchorage does.
And so with these challenges, does that affect how different families pay for their water, or how exactly are those rates set?
Absolutely. It has a huge impact on our rates. You utilize electricity to pump more water than you would expect when you're pumping it up hills. It requires more maintenance to deal with your pump stations, your electrical components, your motors, your processes, your tanks that we have up on top of the hills that they have to be painted, they have to be pressure washed. Our piping systems, we have to have fill lines and we have to have drain lines. So in some places you end up with two lines in the street rather than one that supplies all the same people. So those extra costs are incurred by, you know, the ratepayers. And it's unfortunate, but that's what you pay for living in a beautiful community like Juneau.
Are those costs averaged out over all of the users, or are there different costs depending on where you live in Juneau?
The only difference we have in our costs are based on whether you're a metered client, which is most of our commercial and multi-residential customers, and then we have our flat rate payers, which is your standard customer, say like I am and your neighbor is, unless they have an apartment or a duplex, then they're metered customers. Once again, their rate is different.
Dave, what do you see as some of the long-term challenges in terms of water protection, water sources, water safety? Salmon Creek Dam is over 100 years old. There has been discussion about reopening the AJ mine, and the greatest concern right smack in the middle of that was the water source and the impact on the water purity. Talk a little bit about those issues that you see in the near term, say the next 5 years, and then further out for our community.
So for Salmon Creek, AOMP has done a great job having studies, periodic studies done on the dam. The only concern for the utility is whether or not we're going to have to go to full filtration. Currently, we are meeting, we have filtration avoidance criteria that we are meeting by extra sampling and ensuring that the system does not run or operate when we have high turbidity events, which has to do with big runoff periods, high rain, and so we shut the system down. It's automated to where it shuts down. If it runs for more than 48 hours at a 149, it'll automatically shut down. And then we get to go back and we get to monitor and see what's going on with the water quality. And it's challenging due to the fact that the tourism industry utilizes a lot of water when they come in town. Those ships, they want water. And in the last month, we've had to pull back and regulate heavily how much water we can provide the cruise industry.
You mentioned the term full filtration, and we've been able to avoid it, like it's not a good thing. Tell me a little bit more about that. What is full filtration, and why would we want to avoid that? Is that an additional system that would create some costs?
Well, full filtration, say we go to the full filtration plant, the additional cost would be more manpower, electricity components. The current perimeter of our building is not set up to handle a full filtration plant, whether you go to membrane filters, sand filters, whatever the form is that's the choice that's made to go to full filtration. There's an expense that is incurred with that, and you'll see a direct correlation in your rates if we go to full filtration.
Right now, if I understand what you're saying correctly, our water is minimally treated prior to it going out into the public usage pipelines. Full filtration then would have a system and a process that would affect the water prior to it going out. Is that the difference?
Correct. You know, the flip side of that, the beauty is that that makes Salmon Creek Reservoir no longer an interruptible source. Even when you have turbidity events, we can utilize that water. We could sell more water to the ships if we need to. But currently, we can't do that. We have to pull back. And the town itself, during these dry spells that we just had, the town itself, we cut off the ships because we could not supply them with enough water and keep up with the town's needs. So we already are in a situation where we need to figure out something, if we have any more dry weather, to continue to supply the town's needs.
It's not too frequently that we have to deal with so-called drought conditions here in Juneau, is it?
I'm enjoying it.
Can you address what your role has been in helping the city look at the utilization of Mount Roberts again for some mining?
Well, I've been involved in quite a few meetings. I've been in the mountain itself through the old mine shafts. I've been on some tours through the facilities. And as far as mining goes, I have zero background in mining, so I have no idea how they would go about opening the mine and how they would go about utilizing the water source and protecting the water source if, in fact, if it's at risk with today's technologies. So it's really, for me, it's I have no mining background. I would love to see industry. I'd love to see more jobs. How we get there, I really have no idea.
I know I've heard city officials say protecting the water source and water quality is right at the top of the list, and it sounds like that's what the purpose of your report is as
Absolutely.
Well. And the bottom line is things are good?
Things are great.
Okay.
All right, Dave. So we have the report right here in studio, but where can the public find it?
We have the report published on our website, cbj.org, but we also keep 200 extra copies at our office on Shawn Drive for people that from the general public that would like to come in that don't have a mailing address. These go to all the addresses, the known addresses through the post office that they have a list of in town, and that's how they get out to the public. So if anybody's missed one, they're a renter and they don't have a P.O. box and they have no source and they want to see it and they want to read it, cbj.org, or they can come out to 5433 Shawn Drive and get a copy for themselves.
Are they in the mail right now, Dave?
Yes.
All right. I haven't seen mine yet, but it's good to know that they'll be landing in people's mailboxes in the next few days then. Dave, thanks for joining us and talking about the Juneau Water Quality Report. That's an annual report, and we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
I faced a barren waste without the taste of water, cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water,
water,
cool
water,
clear
water,
water,
water.
The nights are cool and I'm a fool, each star's a pool of water, cool water. But with the dawn, I'll wake and yawn and carry on to water,
water,
cool
water,
clear
water,
water. Keep a moving,
water,
Dan. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man.
Water,
he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me with water?
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling with Lisa Kunow. Our guest is Phoebe Rohrbacher, and she's here to talk about tomorrow evening's testing. Actually, it's tomorrow all day. Is that
mm-hmm.
right, Phoebe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hello. Well, I'm here from the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, or the 4As, and tomorrow's National HIV Testing Day. And so we have some events coming up. I suppose a couple of things we're doing. We have HIV testing all day long in our office, which is 174 South Franklin Street, above Heritage Coffee in the Emporium Mall. And it's the rapid test, and so you can get your results in 20 minutes.
And so what exactly do people need to do for the rapid test? Can they just show up to your office? Do they need to bring any information with them, or how
mm-hmm.
does that work?
There's some minimal paperwork to fill out. The test is free. We ask that people refrain from eating or drinking for an hour before they get the test. But other than that, they just need to bring themselves, you know, and we do ask some personal questions to assess how much at risk they might be and how to, you know, talk with them about how they might lower their risk.
Mm-hmm. So I also hear that there's some new CDC guidelines about HIV testing. Can you explain a little bit more about those?
Yeah. So in April 2013, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention made basically recommend that people aged 15 to 65 get regularly screened for HIV. And so they're thinking that through early diagnosis and identification of folks who have HIV, then you can get them on medications and prevent the spread of the HIV virus, because I think I have some statistics here, and they say that, you know, there's more than 1 million people living with HIV in the country, and there's estimated that 200,000 of those people are unaware that they have the infection, and so, you know, it puts them at risk because they aren't treating their illness, and then it puts other people at risk if they spread it to people.
How have the rates of infection changed recently?
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose, let's see. I have some other notes that I wrote myself. Excuse me for the paper. Let's see. 50,000 people a year are infected.
Nationwide?
Nationwide. but one in five is unaware. So, and then I, you know, for our own statistics for Alaska, we have a really low rate. You know, overall, we probably have an estimated 673 cases of folks presumed to be living with HIV, but there were 341 new diagnoses in Alaska between 2002 and 2010. So, like, that's a 10-year period, pretty much. You know, so it's not, we don't have that many new diagnoses here, but still, there are certain risk factors for, you know, for HIV that that people need to be aware of.
And are there some populations that are more at risk than others here in Alaska, or?
Yeah, you know, we like to say it's not who you are, it's what you do. But, you know, some of the highest risk, the folks who are at highest risk of infection are men who are having sex with men, people with multiple sex partners, injection drug users, and folks who are seeking partners online, especially anonymous partners. And so, you know, HIV, of course, is transmitted through blood and other bodily fluids, of course, but it's not through any casual contact, obviously. So I suppose if you, yeah, basically, even if you don't think you're in a high-risk category, we still recommend that you come and get tested, because now it's kind of the standard thing to do, just to make sure.
So, Phoebe, let's say someone does come back positive for HIV. You know, 20 years ago, that was presumed to be almost a death sentence. That's not the case anymore. So let's say it comes back positive. What happens next? What could someone who has the virus expect then to do?
Yeah, well, at the 4A's, we work, we do prevention, but the majority of our work is through case management, intensive case management for people with HIV and AIDS. So, you know, it might be we would work with that person to help connect them to a doctor and get them into care. If they were going to go on medications, we can assist to help pay for those medications because they're very, very expensive. We, you know, we do everything from helping folks. We basically try to reduce any barriers to that treatment that they might have, whether it's housing or substance abuse issues. You know, we might help get a person into substance abuse treatment, because once they are going to be not dealing with that and having that be the central component of their life, then, you know, then taking the HIV medications would be easier. Or, you know, if the person is in a less than ideal housing situation, you know, we might help to subsidize the housing that they're living in so that they can afford to pay for things like, you know, pay towards their medication or look for a job or, you know.
So it's a resource agency as opposed to just a testing or referral agency.
Yeah.
It sounds like you have some financial resources to help those who may need some support.
Exactly. And then, and then in the prevention end, we do classes and we have the syringe exchange as well as the HIV testing.
I believe you said one in five people has no idea that they're a carrier or have the HIV. And you mentioned the profile of some at-risk behaviors. Are there any physical symptoms that someone might say, you know, this is worth checking out? It could be the virus.
Yeah, well, the thing is, a lot of the symptoms are, you know, when you hear them, they're symptoms that could go along with many other diseases. So, you know, I mean, symptoms would be maybe sweating, heavy sweating at night and cold, you know, and feeling just generally ill for a long time. But the thing is, and, you know, there are a number of symptoms once HIV progresses into AIDS. But the problem is a lot of times the symptoms don't start appearing for as many as 10 years after infection. And so a person can be, you know, feel and look and act completely healthy, but they're still able to transmit the HIV virus.
Seems like that's an extra emphasis then, that particularly if you're having sexual partners that in a that is not a monogamous mm-hmm. relationship, one can't then just tell.
Yeah.
That really getting the screening is about the only for sure way.
Yeah, and I think part of getting the screening, you know, is, and I guess, yeah, you know, I encourage people to get tested, to get screened, and to tell other people that you did it, and to, you know, talk about it, because HIV is still a very real issue in our community and in Alaska and nationwide and worldwide. And I think only through breaking down the stigma of getting tested, you know, you don't have to be, you don't have to necessarily be in a high-risk category to come get tested.
Yeah, you might have interacted mm-hmm. with somebody and you just didn't know.
Exactly. Yeah, high-risk behavior does not mean you're a bad person either, you
sure.
know.
Sure.
So, yeah, it's just, it's good to just get tested and okay. Yeah.
So you mentioned you guys hold classes at your center. So what types of classes do you hold? When do you hold them? Who would be interested?
Yeah, well, we teach classes at Rainforest Recovery, and it's basically just the HIV 101. And we also go to the jail and to Gastineau Human Services. So at the moment, those are the three places. But, you know, we are... I guess if there is a group that you think could wants a class, you know, you can always give me a call.
How about the schools? Do high school health classes, for example, utilize the information?
Occasionally I have gone. We're kind of, you know, in as a, you know, nonprofit. There's always a flux of where we can, what we can do, and it's actually, I guess I've been saying we, but in the Juno office, it's just me. So,
me, myself, and me.
Yeah, so, you know, and I'm mostly doing the case management, so, but we, you know, I have done I was on a panel at Yakus talking about HIV, and so I'm going to go actually to the Zach Gordon Youth Center this evening and do some, tomorrow evening, and do a class. So if you are a youth who could utilize the Zach Gordon Youth Center, and I think all you have to do is be a youth.
Show up.
Then you should show up between 6 and 8:30.
So that's tomorrow night as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah. And then we'll also be at the Viking for the Night Owls. So you can get your dance on and then get an HIV test, or vice versa.
I think they kind of go together.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, a lot of times people do high-risk activities after drinking, and so that's why we put condoms in the bars, and that's why we are going to try to do some HIV testing there. So come on down, 9 p.m.
All
to
right.
12 a.m.
And so where can people find more information if they want to log on? What's your website?
Let's see. It's www.alaskanaids.org. And you can also call the Juno office, 907-586-6089, for more information. And you should check us out on Facebook. We have a lot of updates about what we're doing.
And what would be the Facebook? Is this the same address, Alaskan AIDS?
I believe so. I think you can search us on Facebook. I should know the name of it, or you know what the
or just
the
look for Phoebe Rohrbacher.
Yeah,
and maybe it'll pop up.
Maybe, yeah.
So, thanks for joining us, Phoebe. So tomorrow is HIV testing day. This is a national day,
mm-hmm.
and folks can drop by at 174 South Franklin. That's upstairs above Heritage Coffee,
mm-hmm.
or they can be at the Viking at 9 o'clock on tomorrow night, or
mm-hmm.
if they're a youth, they can drop by the Zach Gordon Teen Center to get some more information. And I imagine folks can get information from you as well regarding the syringe exchange, if that were something that they were interested in.
Absolutely.
And I assume there is full confidentiality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's all confidential, especially, you know, since this is such a small town, it's very, very important to keep everything confidential. And it's the law, so we have to.
So yeah. It's safe and it's free, and there are financial resources for those who may need them.
Yeah.
Great. Why don't you repeat your phone number one more time, Phoebe?
All right. It's 907-586-6089.
Well, thank you for the work that you do, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 26th of June, 2013. It's the birthday of novelist Pearl S. Buck, born in Hillsboro, West Virginia. Her parents were Presbyterian ministers in China, and Buck was born while they were on vacation in the United States. When she was 3 months old, her parents took her back to China, where they had been, and she learned to speak Chinese before she learned to speak English. She fled China after civil war erupted and began writing a novel on the ship to America called East Wind, West Wind. The following year, she published The Good Earth, about a Chinese peasant who becomes a wealthy landowner. At the time, Westerners saw China as one of the most exotic places on earth. Pearl Buck was the first writer to portray the lives of ordinary Chinese people for a Western audience. The novel won a Pulitzer Prize and became an international bestseller. It's the birthday of the blues musician Big Bill Brunzi, born in Scott, Mississippi, in 1898, one of 17 children of parents born into slavery. When he was a young boy, his uncle made him a fiddle from a cigar box and taught him how to play. He later moved to Chicago, learned to play the guitar and sing the blues. He began making recordings and soon became one of the most popular blues singers in the country. He sang at Carnegie Hall. But by the late 40s, the blues began to change with Muddy Waters' electric guitar sound and style. By 1950, Brunzi was working as a janitor at Iowa State University when Studs Terkel rediscovered him and had him on his program as a frequent guest. Eric Clapton later credited Brunzi as one of his strongest influences. And it's the birthday of the poet and memoirist Laurie Lee, born in Stroud, Gloucestershire, England, in 1914. He was the 11th of 12 children, grew up in a tiny English village where everyone lived in crumbling houses with huge families and no electricity or running water. He said, "We lived at the mercy of the seasons, saw little of the outside world, cooked on wood fires and went to bed by candlelight. I belonged to a kind of tribal community which had lasted for 1,000 years, but which since has died out, and I saw the last of it." When he was 15, Laurie Lee dropped out of high school. After working as an errand boy, he walked to London, which took him about a month, sleeping in fields and making money during the day playing his violin. Then later he took off to Spain, where he witnessed the Spanish Civil War. He published many books of poetry during the 1940s without much success, but then he began to write his memoirs, for which he is best remembered. Near the end of his life, he moved back to his hometown and found out that he'd become famous. Tourists came from the cities to see the village that he'd written about in his books, and once a tourist, walking past his garden, asked him if he knew where Laurie Lee was buried. And here's a poem by Carol Ann Duffy titled, "Anon." If she were here, she'd forget who she was. It's been so long. Maybe a nurse, a nanny, maybe a nun. Anon. A girl I met was willing to bet that she still lived on, anon, but had packed it all in, the best verb, the right noun, for a life in the sun. A woman I knew kept her skull on a shelf in a room, anon's, and swore that one day, as she worked at her desk, it cleared its throat as though it had something to get off its chest. A poem by Carol Ann Duffy, Anon, from her collection Feminine Gospels, published by Faber and Faber, and used here by permission on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And this is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will all join us next time.
What's missing between Morning Edition and All Things Considered?
Could it be a comprehensive program of news, analysis, and features in the middle of your day?
That's it.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. And now NPR is combining resources with public radio stations all across the country for Here and Now.
Smart journalists taking you to places you've never been.
With stories that are significant, heartfelt, enlightening.
Starting Monday.
Here and Now.
Don't miss a thing.
Tune in to Here and Now most weekdays from 10 a.m. until noon, with Talk of Alaska until 11 on Tuesdays. Science Friday closes out the week.
Speaking of reporting on NPR, at 8 o'clock tonight, there will be a special NPR wrap-up concerning recent Supreme Court decisions. So be sure to tune in to KTOO this evening at 8 p.m. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling with co-host Lisa Kunow. And our next guest this afternoon is Renee Hughes, who has lived at the Last Chance Mining Museum and helped make that a terrific resource of our community for 20 years. Welcome, Renee. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Renee, so just tell us about the Last Chance Mining Museum.
The Last Chance Mining Museum is located in one of the only buildings that are remaining from the Alaska Juneau Gold Mine, and we are the home of the largest air compressor that the Ingersoll Rand ever made. And it is a wonderful piece of technology that was developed when the mining era was happening. And I consider the AJ to be a major part of the Industrial Revolution because they developed a lot of technology and developed resources like the Salmon Creek Dam to develop our hydroelectric facilities. And a lot of this technology spread throughout the world, and a lot of it is still used today. And the AJ set standards and set records for mining development that we still hold the records for.
And so what other types of things can visitors learn about and see while they're at the museum?
Well, my favorite piece in the museum, other than the big air compressor, is we have a three-dimensional glass map that shows the different levels of the mine that were produced on glass with engineer's ink, and it gives you the dimensions and the levels of a portion of the mine, not the entire mine, but when they were mining, they were doing what is called stope mining, and that's where they would blast upwards. So it's really hard to map a void. But it does show the lower levels, and I have three maps that I really enjoy. One of them is the glass map. There's an aerial photograph that shows where the tunnels go from Sheep Creek, which is over where the Alaska Gastineau mine was, all the way through to the Perseverance mine to us, and then all the way into downtown, which is where we had the mill site, which is right over here behind the K2 building and the wharf on the hillside, which is where they crushed the rocks. And even where we are right now, we're sitting on mine tailings, and I like to tell everyone our streets are paved with gold.
You know, I think Last Chance Mining Museum is literally a hidden treasure in Juneau. Describe where it is and what's the best way to find it.
Well, it is a little hidden treasure because it is a little bit out of town. We are a mile and a half from downtown. And what I tell everyone, if you're going up, you're going in the right direction. So if you go up through downtown, you will come to Basin Road, and there is a wooden trestle that you walk over, and then it turns into a dirt road, which makes you feel like you went from a town to the wilderness very quickly. And if you just follow the dirt road all the way to the end, and you get to Perseverance Trail, we are the large industrial buildings that are on the other side of Gold Creek. And I do offer gold pans for sale, so it's a wonderful recreational fun place to come, learn a little bit about history, bring the family, bring a picnic, pan for gold, strike it rich.
So as you get to that fork in the road where you can go up onto the Perseverance Trail or take a right, you end up in the parking lot, as I recall, and then it's just a very short walk down to the creek and a bridge, and there's that building.
Yes, and you can see the building from the parking lot.
What are your hours?
I'm open 9:30 to 12:30 and 3:30 to 6:30. And a lot of people ask me why I have weird hours. And that's because if I want to come downtown and have lunch, I can do that, or if I need to go to the bank or whatever. But a lot of times I am open all day long. And even if I'm not open, the grounds are always open. And on the level above us is the train level. And there are locomotives and passenger cars and a lot of nice little things that are on the grounds that you're welcome to wander about until I get back. And, you know, right now the wildflowers are beautiful, and it's just a lovely place to come and kind of enjoy being outside and learning
and
a little
back
bit.
And in history a little bit. And as we opened this segment of the show, we said you live there as well. So when you say, I need to go to the bank or I'm running into town, you mean that quite literally because you do live there.
Well, for me to walk to town and walk back, then, yeah, it will take me that long.
So it sounds like you have a need for volunteers. So what types of positions do you have available, and who do you think would be great for those positions?
Well, we have two different types of volunteers. My husband, Gary, and I, we kind of have the building split in half. I run the museum, which is the meet and the greet, and talk about the history and visit with the visitors and just enjoying the people. And my husband, he does the shop. And he does all the preservation work. If you walk up there, he's restored 28 windows, and his doors are absolutely craftsman, beautiful works of art as far as a door is concerned. And they're all historically correct. So the guys and some girls, they putz around in the shop. And we also, the Historic Society manages the, you know, our property, basically, but we also have a lighthouse, and so there's always work to be done, and everybody needs, you know, a little extra help with a hammer and nail, sweeping dust.
You said that rather casually. Oh, we also have a lighthouse. Is that a project that you and Gary are working on together on behalf of the city, or what's that about?
That's as part of the Historic Society.
It is. How mm-hmm. exciting. What kind of training would be necessary if one were to become, say, either the meet and greet or the hands-on volunteer up there?
Well, I usually have a volunteer come and spend a day with me, and each shift is only 3 hours. So you come and I will show you around and kind of give you the combination and show you where the light switches are. And then Mary Lou King, she put together a little historic book about the lighthouse, I mean about the museum, excuse me, and it identifies all the different artifacts in the museum. So it's a great little way. So if you're a little confused about something, you can just go, oh, what is this? And look it up, and you'll have a better understanding of what it is and why it's there and what it was used for.
What a great resource. How long has the museum been open? I know the building has been there, what, maybe 100 years?
1912.
And when did it open as a museum?
It's had a very sporadic history. Gary and I have been running it for 18 years. Prior to that, Hoochinoo and Hotcakes operated there in the 60s. Gary got a grant in the early 80s, so it's kind of been off and on, but we've got the longest history going.
Well, thanks for your service in keeping that museum open. I'd like to thank Renee Hughes for joining us this afternoon on Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, Shona Strasser will host. We'll learn about placing foreign exchange students with Patty Kalbrenner from STS. John Hunt will join us to highlight 4th of July activities. We'll note details about this weekend's Juno Symphony Chamber Concerts, and Nancy DeCherney, as usual, will be here with Arts Up. That's Writer's Almanac, Music and More, Thursday at 3 on KTOO News. Don't forget, if you miss a Juno afternoon or want to listen again, you can catch it and other local, statewide, national, and international news at KTOO.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Laurie Scandling with co-host Lisa Kunow, and on the board is Jeff Brown. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, some patchy fog as well. Highs around 60, and that will continue for the next day or two. Don't forget, 8 p.m. tonight, special NPR coverage of Supreme Court decisions. This is KTOO.org. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Limerin and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus is at K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear us on K210 AS 89.9. And you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, KXLL at 873. And we're online at www.ktoo.org. Thanks for joining us.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. A victory on two fronts today for supporters of same-sex marriage. First, the Supreme Court, in a closely watched decision, announced that it is in essence striking down the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, which denied federal benefits to married gay couples. Rejecting part of DOMA, the High Court ruling in favor of an 84-year-old woman, Edith Windsor, who, after her partner died, was left owing more than